I've been thinking about what to talk to you about, and I suppose there's a few things that are quite live for me at the moment. I've been doing a bit of writing rather than speaking. I've been turning some talks, a series of talks I gave on the bodhicitta many years ago, which some friends of mine very kindly transcribed because they thought they were good talks. So I've been working away trying to turn them into a Padmaloka booklet. It's definitely not going to be a proper book. That, we don't need another, you know, book on Buddhism. But certainly a modest Padmaloka booklet, I think, might be okay. But what I found doing in the introduction to this was, the talks needed a complete rewrite. It's very different, the discipline of writing to talking, because you rely so much on presence and tone when you speak, but when you write, you've got to be much more exact and careful. But what I found myself doing was talking about how I come to discover the bodhicitta. Which, you know, as Vedanya said yesterday, is virtually impossible to translate. I'm thinking of it, yes, the enlightened mind, but it's the sort of, I also think of it as the force of wisdom and compassion, which arises in one and takes one to, transforms one completely into, you know, fully into the force of wisdom and compassion. I haven't made that up. That comes from my teacher, from Bhante. But I found it quite interesting just to really look at how I discovered this particular way of looking at things or even experiencing things. And, and of course I had to go right back into early experiences, pre-Buddhist, when I was a youngster, and I suppose I described them as experiences of at the time I thought they were experiences of grace, of the grace of God and things like that. That was the framework that I had, and sort of ecstatic, transporting experiences. I think it's very important to understand, however, that this is in a context of a lad who was very, very rough and ready. Football playing, football loving, sport loving, mucking about kind of lad, you know, nothing spiritual at all, I would say, you know, very, very rough and ready indeed. When we're talking about these sort of elevated subjects, don't get the idea, because sometimes people think, you know, when they find out they'd got involved in the Dharma so young, that, oh, you must have been so mature and developed. I wasn't. I was an adolescent. I was a kid. I was very confused. Thank goodness I found all this. Thank goodness I found the Dharma. But nonetheless, there was something that touched me very, very deeply, which got me searching at quite a young age, got me reading about the Dharma. Fortunately, I found Lama Govinda's books, Foundations of Tibetan Mysticism, The Way of the White Clouds, which had a very, very big effect on me. They spoke right to the heart, as well as to the head, I have to say, even though I didn't really understand it. There was a clarity in these books that was very helpful. And it was very, very clear from Lama Govinda's book. So I was, what, by this time, 17, I think. It was very clear that you needed two things if you were going to live a Buddhist life. You needed to find a guru. You needed to find a guru who would give you the direct transmission of the Dharma, initiate you into the quick way, the profound path, and you needed to meditate. You needed to have find a guru who'd teach you meditation, and so that you'd have the full experience of the Dharma. And of course, Lama Govinda is quite a romantic sort of writer. You know, with these wonderful lamas in Tibet, and I did write off to a Tibetan monastery in Scotland. Very heartfelt letter, how I wanted to live the Bodhisattva ideal and all this sort of thing. I didn't get a reply. They must have thought I was a nutter, I think, looking back. If I'd got the letter that I'd written, I would have, I would have wondered. So no go there. And just by chance, I found that a group calling themselves the Friends of the Western Buddhist Order, which I've often said I found an extremely boring sounding name. I mean, they weren't proper Buddhists anyway, because they were just friends of Western Buddhists, you know. So it was a very odd name. But they were starting things in Brighton. That was the local town for me. And I went along there. And my first, I was very excited about going. I really thought I was going to be finding my guru. Hopefully he'd be wearing red robes and he'd be Tibetan. And I'd be, you know, these stories that, you know, in Lama Govinda's book, you meet one of these teachers and there's a kind of instant enlightenment almost. You know, and anyway, I went along, and it was a little bit disappointing at first, because Buddhadasa, who was doing things in this front room in Preston Park near Brighton, it was just an ordinary house, looked very ordinary. It was very English, even though he turned out to be, I found out he was Welsh later, much later. Very English, middle class sort of chap, jumper, jeans, but very ordinary. You know, friendly enough. But that evening he taught the Metta Bhavana, which I struggled with as I tried to sit in full lotus. But then, which I couldn't do. And then there was the Sevenfold Puja. That was my first class. And thank goodness it was, as far as I'm concerned, because by the end of the puja, I knew very, very clearly that I was going to be a Buddhist. I even knew I was going to be a member of the order. I didn't know what the order was. I'd only just met one, but there was this absolutely definitive clarity that this was my life. And it was definitely the puja and the mantras. When I chanted the mantras, I knew. I knew that this was going to be my life. I can't tell you how I knew, or anything like that, but I just knew. So I have a great love of the Sevenfold Puja from that time. And the mantras at the end. There wasn't lots of chanting. In those days, we didn't have all the sort of chanting with the offerings. It's just the seven stages with the Heart Sutra and then the mantras. And that was enough. So what was that a bit? But I'll say a little bit more. So, you know, naturally, I was still living at home. I was working as a market gardener. Training for my city and guilds in horticulture with not, you know, rather half-heartedly. I'd left school at 16. But I just kept going down to Brighton as much as I could. And eventually Buddhadasa found a property up in Kemp Town and a couple of terraced houses and turned that into a little nascent community and a wonderful Buddhist centre and bookshop. And Buddhadasa was a very inspiring man, actually, because he just lived it. He lived the life very fully. I mean, when I moved into the little community, I remember waking up in the morning hearing him do his 100 prostrations. He'd do 100 prostrations every morning before the day's work. Very, very inspiring to come across somebody like that. Sometime early on, it might have been when we had the centre, or it might have even been before that, I heard a lecture, probably on a reel-to-reel tape recorder. So we're talking about about 1974, so it's a long time ago. We listened to a lot of Bhante's lectures. There weren't many books in those days. There were Indian editions of the survey with a very particular smell to them. I think there was The Essence of Zen, Mind Reactive and Creative, a few FWBO newsletters, very, very few of material from Bhante. There were Buddhist books coming out, like the Bodhicharavatara came out at that time and a few others, old translations of the Pali Canon, but not a lot. So there were these wonderful tape series. And at a certain point, I listened to that series aspects of the Bodhisattva ideal. And the lecture that was particularly important was the lecture called The Awakening of the Bodhi Heart. And I realized when I was writing this introduction to this piece, this book that I'm trying to do, that this was really incredibly formative to me. So I'm 17, I've got a very, it's very, very early days. I've had some sort of experiences of one kind or another, but listening to this lecture, I think, has been absolute foundation of my Buddhist life. You know, it's right through everything, all the ups and downs. And it's the way in which Bhante talks about the bodhicitta. The way he talks about the bodhicitta. He talks about the fact that very often the term bodhicitta is translated as the thought of enlightenment. And he said it's definitely not a thought of enlightenment. It's not a thought at all. You might be sitting there thinking about enlightenment, but that is not the bodhicitta in any way, shape or form. He said it's not just, and he said, gave various translations of the term bodhicitta. He said all of them are unsatisfactory, all of them. And he said, in fact, you could even say it's a problem with language itself. The bodhicitta is not a good word for the bodhicitta. He said, because you're talking about something which is beyond all language. And he refers to a small work by Nagarjuna that he'd encountered in a book by D.T. Suzuki called Outlines of Mahayana Buddhism. Some people say it's not by Nagarjuna, this little text. Doesn't matter. Tradition says it is, so there. Mr. Scholars. And in this little work called the Bodhicitta Vivarana, or the exposition of Bodhicitta, Nagarjuna says, apparently, that, well, I've looked at it, not apparently, that the Bodhicitta is not a self, it's not an Atman, it's not a Swabhava, it doesn't have any self nature. It's not to be found in any of the five skandhas and the sense media. So in other words, it's not found in any part of the sort of conditioned human personality. And yet, the bodhicitta is universal and it is the Mahakaruna Chitta, which is literally the greatly compassionate heart, but which Suzuki translates as the great loving heart. And bodhisattvas, their whole reason for being is because of this bodhicitta. And Bhante takes from that that the bodhicitta is a wholly, he admits it's, we're outside of language. So all words here are entirely provisional. So it's something transcendental. It's not part of the conditioned, constructed experience. It's beyond all words and all language. It's no individual personal possession. And yet, it arises, manifests in individuals. So this is why he talks about it as a kind of cosmic will to enlightenment. Highly poetic language. Don't take it literally. And he used an analogy, and this is where we get it, things get a little bit dangerous now, I think. And please don't misunderstand, especially if you've got a kind of universalist tendency in you. He said the arising of the bodhicitta is analogous to the descent of the Holy Spirit in the disciples. He's not saying it's the same thing. It's very, very important. So he says you might be thinking about God, and if you were a Christian, you might be thinking about those things. But if you use the language of the descent of the Holy Spirit, it's rather different. So he says the bodhicitta in Buddhist literature is more like that. It's not anything to do with God, because remember, it's not an Atman, it's not a self, it's not a personality. It's altogether beyond language. But it seems from the tradition, the way in which the great teachers and the people in the tradition describe the arising of the bodhicitta as something absolutely wonderful, as Vedanya indicated yesterday, seems to be something that sort of descends and animates people. It seems to be something even of a surprise. I mean, Shantideva in the Bodhicharyavatara, you know, is just amazed that it's happened. He says, the image he uses, it is like a blind man finding a jewel in a heap of dung. Somehow, so in the same way, somehow or other, the bodhicitta has arisen in me. I take that to mean that he's been so absorbed in his Dharma life, in his Dharma practice, so completely engaged in it, not thinking about attainment or whether he's this or whether he's that or the other, way out beyond any ideas of status, so concerned with his ethics, his meditation, his study, his puja, so concerned with that, that it's an enormous surprise that suddenly he can realize that there is the arising of this bodhicitta, this force, this impetus of wisdom and compassion, towards wisdom and compassion in its fullness. In its fullness. And it's quite clear from Shantideva's text that he doesn't have any kind of conceit whatsoever. Rather, he's as well as feelings of gratitude and wonder, which are expressed in the puja, and tremendous gratitude, there is also this sense of tremendous self-criticism and self-censure. Very, very aware of his failings and faults, and aware that they inhibit not just his own development, but the development of everybody. Because he's taken a vow to liberate all life. No longer is he living for himself. So he's very aware of the impact of his failings on other people. Whether internal failings, giving into to klesha, the defilements, and not making effort in Dharma life, or whether the effect he has directly on others. It's very, very moving to read passages of the Bodhicharyavatara. So all this material had a huge impact on me. A huge impact on the whole way I looked at the Dharma life, and the whole idea that it was just something that you sort of, as it were, did within your own mind, it didn't make sense to me. But the whole idea that you were working on yourself, yes, but opening up to something beyond you, that wasn't a god or anything like that, but which was this force of wisdom and compassion, to use that language, and particularly imaged in the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, that made complete sense to me. Complete and utter sense. But of course, there's also the compassionate or the loving emphasis. This is a tricky one, because I can't say that I've ever felt that I'm a compassionate person. Certainly wasn't in those days, though I can't think of a hint of it, really. Or a loving person. I find it very hard to think in those terms. But it made complete sense that a Dharma life had to include both self and other. You know, that you could not have a Dharma life without being engaged profoundly with other people, and that working on yourself was a way to benefit others. And being engaged with others, practicing generosity, working for the Dharma and so on, was having an effect on you within this overall context of something which transcended self and other, which transcended you. That made complete sense. I can't say I would have been able to have put it in those words at the time. It was more of a feeling, more of a flavour, I think. But that's why I'm an order member. That's why I live this life. Doesn't mean I've sorted it out. It doesn't mean that I haven't made enormous, terrible, you know, mistakes over the years in my life. But that's what I work with, you know, from then on, I think. That's what I felt I was living for and really trying to serve. And as time went on, you know, Bhante's sort of insight into the bodhicitta sort of deepened and deepened. You know, he started to say that he thought the bodhicitta, well, it wouldn't just arise in a lone individual. It would be more like arising within a community, a spiritual community. Doesn't mean necessarily living together, but it might include that, but something like an order, where you've got people intensively engaging with the Dharma life together, that would more likely attract something like the bodhicitta. But more than that, that there's something about spiritual attainment, Dharma attainment, where the whole notion, this is for me, loses its meaning. Attainment too is emptiness. We have to understand that, I think, in the context of the bodhicitta. And who is giving that teaching of the Heart Sutra. It's Avalokiteshvara giving that teaching of the Heart Sutra. These are the words of a bodhisattva. Attainment to his emptiness can mean, well, I'm not thinking of attainment for myself as opposed to others. It must include others. It must include all life. Bhante often used to talk about insight in the early days as seeing through self and other, seeing through the subject-object dichotomy, you know, a phrase that we all got very excited about, and really working out a Dharma life that, you know, would really include that dimension of things, the other regarding dimension. But also eventually starting to talk about the order as the expression, as trying to manifest the 11-headed and 1,000-armed Avalokiteshvara, this sort of image of Mahakarunika, the greatly compassionate one, that every order member is a hand of Avalokiteshvara, connected to all other order members in and through the bodhicitta that transcends, you know, self and other. Very, very inspiring language. So this is, you know, this has had a huge effect on my life and still does. It's the way I see things, the way I approach things, and not as an idea, I think, more as a sort of something much more heartfelt, you know, than that. It's why I'm, one of the reasons why I'm a disciple of Bhante, and yes, why I live this life in the order. So I've been you know, thinking quite a lot about that, but it's also related to this theme of reverence, which Vidanya, you know, also talked about yesterday and has come up, and it's sort of been a bit in the air in the movement lately because Bhante has, you know, did a little article on some further reflections on the Garuda Sutta that we had read last night. He obviously thinks it's very important. And I know other order members have been talking quite a lot about it in different contexts, how important this is. And I want to, again, talk about my little journey into the whole area of reverence, because it isn't a notion that's new to me. Again, I would say it goes back to my sort of formative times in the movement and the order. I think, again, related to early experience that I think I was always looking to be able to revere. I was brought up in the Anglican church, sort of high-ish Anglican church. I think my father would have liked the local church we went to be even a bit higher. He was brought up with the smells and bells in his high church in North London, St. Peter le Poor, if anybody knows it. So he was brought up in that. But anyway, we were reasonably high at Ditchling. Not quite high enough, but we were reasonably high in Sussex. And I didn't really take to Christianity at all from the off. But I think it's interesting that there was this sense of the sacred and of revering the sacred. I wanted that. I knew I wanted that within all the midst of the confusion of childhood and adolescence and all the sort of problems with that. There was something that deeply wanted to revere and serve and to open, you know, to that dimension of things. And thank goodness, you know, that eventually I came across the Dharma. I could understand, you know, this emotion more deeply. Well, not just the Dharma, but Bhante's exposition of it. And I remember very early on in the movement, that Bhante gave a couple of, just before I think I was around, Bhante gave a lecture called The Path of Regular and the Path of Irregular Steps. And a few months or maybe a year later, he gave a talk called Enlightenment as Experience and as Non-Experience, which I did manage to go to, where again the theme of reverence I think was quite strong and more implied. But in The Path of Regular and Irregular Steps, he talks about reverence quite strongly. And I remember it made an impact. It was something that stuck in my mind and was sort of lodged there. So I want to just read from that. I think it's good that you hear a bit of Bhante. he's been in this was a lecture given under the auspices of the Buddhist Society. So we're talking about 1974 or 5. The Buddhist Society, had sort of been in Christmas, had been sort of instrumental in expelling Bhante from the Hampstead Buddhist Vihara, and that had led to the starting of the movement and so on. But this was a period when there was, people wanted, to build bridges, and there was a very good secretary of the Buddhist Society at the time, who I believe was a Mitra, and he arranged for Bhante to give some lectures introduced by Christmas Humphreys. And the first one was so packed out, the Buddhist Society, with all the members and mitras and friends, that they had to hire a big hall in central London for the second lecture. But what Bhante did in this lecture, he said, what do we see when we look at the Buddhist world? We see hundreds and hundreds of books. He says, that's what we see. And he talked about the way in which people had cut most people's engagement with Buddhism was intellectual, and it's all about understanding. And I still think what he says is very relevant, even though we've got a lot more people practicing Buddhism. But I think the points he's making still stand. He talks about understanding. Understanding means appropriating. It means taking the object of knowledge unto oneself. It means, as it were, taking it into oneself, making it one's own, a part of oneself. And for this reason, because understanding means appropriating, we speak in terms of mastering a subject. We speak in terms of mastering, say, accountancy, mastering mathematics. And we even speak, or at least think, of sort of mastering Buddhism. So because we understand Buddhism, we think we understand, we think we have understood, because we have appropriated, made part of ourselves, we become, or we feel, sort of superior to Buddhism. We've incorporated it. We've made it part and parcel of ourselves. So we feel superior to Buddhism. And because we feel superior to it, because we know we've mastered it, we don't look up to it. Because we don't look up to it, because we think we've understood it, we think we've mastered it, we don't feel towards Buddhism any real devotion, any real reverence. We're devoid of that. There's no feeling, no looking up, no warmth, no devotion, no reverence. We have just mastered the subject. Now, this kind of attitude is not new in this country, in the West. It's by no means confined to modern Western Buddhists. This sort of attitude has been widespread in the Western world for quite a long time. And 150 years ago, even, we find the great poet and thinker Coleridge complaining about this sort of attitude, complaining, of course, within a Christian context. We find that on May the 15th, 1833, he delivered himself of these sentiments. There is now no reverence for anything. And the reason is that men possess conceptions only, and all their knowledge is conceptual only. Now, as to conceive is a work of the mere understanding, and as that all that can be conceived may be comprehended, it is impossible that a man should reverence that to which he must always feel something in himself superior. If it were possible to conceive God in a strict sense, that is, as we conceive a horse or a tree, even God himself could not excite any reverence. And reverence, Coleridge goes on to say, is only due from man, and is only excitable in man towards ideal truths, which are always mysteries to the understanding. For the same reason that the motion of my finger behind my back is a mystery to you now, your eyes not being made for seeing through my body. This is Bhante again. So this is what Coleridge said on the subject of lack of reverence 150 years ago. And at about the same time, we find in Germany an even greater poet, an even greater thinker, saying much the same thing, but rather more briefly than Coleridge. We find Goethe in his Reflections and Maxims saying, the finest achievement for men of thought is to have fathomed the fathomable and quietly to revere the unfathomable. Bhante to finish. So we may say that it is this quiet revering of the unfathomable, that which cannot be understood, cannot be comprehended, which is atakavachara in Buddhist terminology, beyond the reach of thought, beyond the reach of understanding and conception. It's this quiet revering of the unfathomable that until recently has been so lacking among Western Buddhists. We may say that we've been much too quick to understand, much too ready to speak, even about the unfathomable. In fact, we can even say that we've been much too ready to speak, especially about the unfathomable. As a kid, I was a teenager when I heard that. It had a huge effect on me, in the sense of, when I say an effect, I don't necessarily mean it made me a better reverential person, but it made complete sense. It was speaking to something I knew, this quiet revering of the unfathomable. Bhante's not saying that we shouldn't try to understand and be clear about the Dharma. We do need to have an intellectual clarity, of course we do. But within the context of this quiet revering of the unfathomable, this quiet revering of the atakavachara, which of course is the Buddha's words for nirvana itself. Nirvana is atakavachara. It's beyond the reach of reasoning. It's beyond the reach of understanding. That's why I think we have to be extremely careful when people talk very freely about these deep teachings and doctrines like anatman and shunyata, and me talking about the bodhicitta. Let's be clear. We really need to do that within the context of a deep revering. So that had a very, very big effect on me, and I've been sort of looking back at it and really trying to look at my life more, what really needs to sort of change in the light of what does revering mean? I've been aware for a long time of the meaning of the word Gaurava intellectually, but I mean feeling the meaning. There are other things in the journey to understand Gaurava, but let's just look at the word a little bit more. The Pali Gaurava, Sanskrit Gaurava, and it's translated as reverence, but the root meaning of Gaurava, it comes from a root meaning heavy, weighty. Doesn't sound very attractive, does it? But I think what's being got at here, you revere, you look up to, you, and when I use the word revere, there's elements always of cherishing, of carefulness, of treating things very, very carefully and appropriately. I think that's included in reverence. But you revere that which has real weight for you, real gravity. It's deeply moved you. You don't understand it fully. You don't understand it to any degree, really. But there is something there that has a real presence that you've encountered. It might be in a person. It might be in communicated through a text. It might be, it might just be there. It's very hard to sort of say where it is, but it has this deep, profound effect on you. And you know it's not to do with the conditioned, with the world, simply with sense experience. It's not anti-sense experience, but it's something that is beyond that, that you can't comprehend and encompass through the senses and the rational mind. It's something breaking through that or animating that. It's very, very difficult to talk about. So I think, it's more like, you revere that which is holy, to use a, a word that we probably wouldn't use, that which is sacred. And really, I think where I have to question the degree to which I'm reverential, or I've been reverential in my life. So I think reverence has the effect of a greater carefulness about everything. Not just in relation to images of the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas and what you do in a puja and, you know, the way you read the Dharma, although it will be all those things. It will come out also in the relation to the way you treat others, the way you treat people. It's very interesting that in another early lecture, wonderful lecture by Bhante called Discerning the Buddha that he gave way back in the 1980s. You know, why we didn't make more of that lecture, I don't know, but a wonderful lecture looking at the Buddha's enlightenment. This is where the first time he talks about the Gaurava Sutta beautifully. He gives this teaching of the six Gauravas, the six different things that you need to revere for a full Dharma life. It's found in various suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya. It's found. You revere, yes, the Sutta, the Buddha as the teacher, interestingly enough, not just as the enlightened one, but as the teacher of gods and men, the one who has shown the way to enlightenment, unique. But also, by implication, you're going to be revering all of your teachers, actually from your parents onward. In Indian tradition, your parents are described as your first gurus. And incidentally, the word guru is traditionally related to Gaurava. A guru is somebody weighty with qualities. That's what a guru is. Heavy with Dharma qualities. That's why you would revere them. So yes, you revere the Buddha as the teacher. Unique teacher who is teaching enlightenment, communicating the Atthagavachara. But by implication, you revere all the teachers who've benefited you. And yes, even your parents are regarded as your first teachers. In the Dhammapada, I found a verse the other day where it says, here, reverence for mother is good. Here, reverence for father is good. Here, reverence for teachers is good. Here, reverence for the Buddha is good. Something like that. And you'll have to look up the quotation. But it's very, very striking. Very, very striking. And of course, you know, it really raises questions, because I know, you know, many of us can have difficulties with our parents and so on and so forth. But certainly I think one of the ways in which Bhante kind of communicates, talks about this, is how important it is to establish a positive, if you can't establish a positive relationship with your parents, at least from your point of view, a positive attitude towards them, because they have such an impact on your life. And such an impact on your entire emotional life and all of your relationships. And I think it can be hard sometimes to naturally feel reverence if we have difficulties. One of the early things I learned from Bhante was the importance of a positive attitude to parents. Because he knew very, very well how that can affect all one's relationships. Perhaps even our relationship with the Buddha. But anyway, you revere the Sutta, the teacher. You revere the Dhamma, of course. You revere the Sangha, especially the Arya Sangha. But then it comes down to other things. This is really unusual. I've never heard this teaching before. You revere your Sikha. You revere your training. What an amazing idea. You revere the ethics you practice. You revere the meditation you practice. You revere the wisdom that you're trying to develop. There's quite a thought. How carefully do we treat our training? Are we a bit sort of slapdash with, you know, our ethics and our meditation? I remember when Bhante gave that lecture on the Ten Pillars of Buddhism. There's a book, The Ten Pillars of Buddhism, and fortunately we study it every year here. How I realised that I didn't revere the precepts I'd taken at ordination. I didn't value them highly enough. And the way he expounds just the first precept, the real meaning of the first precept, the way he talks about imaginative identification with others and moving from power mode to love mode, and it's so profound. I thought, well, I haven't taken this precept seriously. And the reason why I failed in that precept is because I haven't revered it. Mm. I haven't cherished it. I haven't valued it deeply enough. I haven't worshipped it, if you like, even to use that sort of language. So you revere your training, you revere your metta bhavana. Before you do the metta bhavana, spend some time just going through the qualities of metta. Worship metta, and then do the metta. Worship mindfulness, revere mindfulness. Bring the Buddha to mind as that incredibly mindful, loving man before you meditate. Then do the metta and the mindfulness. Revering meditation, yes, revering wisdom. Revering wisdom. It's not simply about, you know, mugging up on, you know, skandhas and sense fields and conditioned co-production and the different kinds of shunyata. We need to revere wisdom. We need to revere, you know, what's seen. And actually, revering wisdom is revering the very, very simple teachings. You know, when you read what the Buddha has to say about impermanence, and what it really means to have an insight into impermanence, and what it does to a man to have an insight into impermanence, you realise, well, do I revere that? Do I really cherish that? Do I take that really seriously and care for that teaching? Or am I sort of slapdash, you know, with it? So there's the revering of our training. There's the revering of apramada, which can be translated as mindfulness or awareness, vigilance. But Bhante says that in a sense, it's really standing for all the qualities of the Dharma that you're trying to develop in your life. It's revering, because awareness is part of all positive states. So it's an awareness of a revering of the qualities you're trying to develop along the path as you go along. And finally, there's the revering of patisantara. Very hard to translate patisantara. You could translate it as a spread, a banquet laid out. So one interpretation is you're revering the whole range of the Dharma. I think this might be related to, what was it, Vedanya's bright blur that he reveres in puja. But patisantara could also mean friendship. You revere friendship. The fact of Dharma friendship, of Kalyana Mitrita. You revere the Bodhisattva ideal. You revere the whole way of spreading out the Dharma for others and welcoming them into the Dharma. So wonderful way of looking at the Dharma life, revering your whole Dharma life, your whole Dharma practice. So this is, you know, comes out of this practice of reverence, this having this sense of the weight, the deep, heavy, positive, in the positive sense, the Dharma weight, the profundity of the Dharma that we've been given. It's very interesting. I think it's related as well when we talk about this to the whole area of faith, Shraddha. Again, something that Bhante said years ago, which I'm only just beginning to dimly understand, which occurred in the retreat center lounge, where we had a seminar on mind and Buddhist psychology, which became the Know Your Mind material, mind in harmony material. And I remember when we were talking about Shraddha, about faith, fancying myself as somebody with lots of faith and reverence and devotion. Well, that was quickly, quickly dealt with. He talked how difficult it is to talk about faith. He said it's this quality of being, it does have a touch of the transcendental within it, that touch of the Ataka Vacharo, a reflection of it. It's very hard to, you know, because of that, it's very, very hard to talk about it. It's very hard to say, I've got it. That sort of doesn't come into it. He said it would probably be, you'd notice it in somebody, you'd notice it in the way they conduct themselves. Their whole demeanour. The whole care with which they conduct their life. He said, curiously, it's sort of related a bit to the meaning of religion in the archaic medieval sense. I had to do bit of work on that. Nobody had the sense to ask him what he meant by that at the time. He said it could also be associated with a sort of fear. Now this might sound a bit strange, that sort of language, because we tend to associate fear with a negative and unskillful state. But I think what he's getting at is that you're very, very careful. When you revere, you have this awareness of your actions having consequences. You're much more tuned up to karma. Indeed, one aspect of Shraddha is this trusting Shraddha, this clear conviction that you know that actions have consequences. You know that there is karma. You know that your skillful actions are going to have a beneficial effect. You know that your unskillful actions are going to have a negative effect. And you're very, very careful about that for self and other. You're very alert and mindful to that in all your actions of body, speech and mind. This is all part of reverence. This is all part of living this life with this awareness of the weight, if you like, of reality. So very, very important, I think, to, you know, the sort of qualities which we can read very quickly in a text, but we have to sort of really take them in, I think, and see where we are in relation to them. That's what I'm sort of doing at the moment, I think, in my own life. Another element, and then I think I need to start winding up in my journey to understanding this area of things, was a very early seminar I went on, my first seminar with Bhante, which was a weekend retreat. I'd moved to London by then. I wasn't ordained. I was a little mitra. Again, still 19 by now, I guess, living in the squats around Archway in North London. And in a little community that we had, and Loka Mitra decided to take a group of us away for a weekend up into a farm house in Thetford Forest, Brim House Farm, where we used to do retreats, where I was eventually ordained. And he went off and said, I've just got to go off, I'll come back a bit later. So we were getting the place ready, and he came back with Bhante. Bhante had decided as a special treat to do a weekend seminar for us. So there was no invitations, no advertising, no things sent out, you know, all that kind of thing, malarkey that we get now, we have to go through. This is Bhante, our teacher, turning up, put on his robes, we're going to do a study weekend together with us and the lads and Loka Mitra. We were all quite young at the time, and it was on the Mangala Sutta. And it was a wonderful little seminar, again, formative, and I've been sort of revisiting it, doing study groups on it, because it's so wonderful. It's just one of these short suttas. The Buddha is visited by a deva who lights up the whole of the Jetta Grove at the deva hour, early in the morning. And the deva asks, what are the auspicious signs? What are the auspicious signs? What are the mangalas? How can you tell if things are going to turn out well and going to be good? Very important in India. And Bhante very aware of all that from having lived in India, very much a part of Indian culture, so he could really talk from the inside. And the Buddha just lists all these, you know, qualities really, which are the real signs of good luck signs. Mangala can just mean luck, lucky. But there was one verse: Garavo chinivatocha santuti jakatanyuta kalena dhamma savanam etam mangalam uttamam. Reverence, humble-heartedness, contentment and gratitude, and listening to the Dhamma at proper times, this is the most auspicious sign of all. Reverence, humble-heartedness, contentment and gratitude, and listening to the Dhamma at proper times, this is the most auspicious sign of all. There's a little path, a little teaching here, isn't there, of qualities. So you first have this sense of reverence. You've encountered that which is beyond the Ataka Vachara. It's really you're revering it, you're cherishing it. You've touched that which is beyond, that which is sublime, profound. I think an early translator translates it as reverend awe, A-W-E, you know, this sense of awe, of wonder, the sublime. And that leads to nirvata, which is translated as humble-heartedness. Nirvata is a very interesting word, because vata means wind, windy. Vata is gas, wind. but a conceited person is a puffed up, a windy person. They're full of wind. So nirvata means, well, you haven't got any wind. You're not puffed up, you're not proud, you're not conceited. So, you know, that's what happens when you encounter, you know, the sublime, when you're touched by that which is beyond. When you genuinely revere, conceit goes. You're not pretending to be humble, that's another form of conceit. In a way, you can't do humility. It's something which, which is a sort of grace, really. It's, I guess, a sense of proper proportion. It's very interesting, the analysis of conceit in Buddhism is the view that you are superior to others. That's the way we think of pride and conceit, isn't it? We're looking down on others. But it's also the view that you're inferior to others. Oh, I'm so lowly. You know, I can't. You know, I'm lower than everybody. Well, that's a massive ego trip. That's a real excuse, isn't it, not to do anything with your life and to avoid responsibility, you know, and so on. That's as bad as, you know, I'm superior to everybody attitude in some ways. But even the view that you're equal is regarded as a conceit. That's really interesting in these pseudo-egalitarian times, as Bantu might call them, that the view that I'm equal to you and you're equal to me, rather aggressively sometimes. That can be sort of asserted. Some are more equal than others, you know, in George Orwell's famous saying. I think that's that, you know, you sort of get that, you know, your egalitarian credentials. This is all an expression of a lack of reverence. It's all because you are not really cherishing and really caring for and really have a full awareness, a cherishing awareness of that which is beyond, that which is genuinely greater than you. That's why we have all these problems. And you have a sense of proportion, I think, when that's in place. You know, in that wonderful feeling that you of being able to really surrender to that. I'll use that word. Of really being able to acknowledge there is something greater than me. There really is. Even there are people greater than me. There really are people greater than me. It's an enormous relief, actually. And it leads to contentment. Santuti, that lovely word, contentment, santushti. You're content. Because in a way, things are rightly ordered. There's a sense of the proper order of things. It's not a fixed order. It can never be fixed. You know, that's not the nature, as Arloka was saying yesterday, the Dharma is about change and transformation. But there's that sense of there's no need for anxiety and restlessness. I don't need this and I don't want that. I don't need to go after these possessions and those possessions and chase this person and that person. There's a contentment. There's a deep contentment because I've found what is really important in life. And gratitude, katanyata. Gratitude is such an important quality in Buddhism. Katanyata, kritajnana in Sanskrit, is knowledge of the benefits that you've received. Knowledge of what you've been given. You really know, not just as an idea, but with your heart, what you've been given. I think this is something that I don't do anywhere near enough. Just going through in my mind what I've received from others. Directly from people I know, indirectly from people, you know, all around in my world, in my society, through history. We are a receipt of so much. Just to be human. Just to be free. just to be living in a relatively free society. We complain enormously about our government and this and that, and, you know, moan and moan and moan. Believe me, we have enormous freedoms. You know, to be free to come together on a weekend to practice the Dharma in this sort of environment is extraordinary. To have the blessing of health, to have the blessing of friends. We are in receipt of so much, and we need to be practicing far more gratitude. You know, regularly, every day, going through what we've been given and what we're resting on. Well, I reckon if I did that, I'd gain enlightenment. Indeed, I think gratitude is one of the first times you're getting a real insight into conditioned co-production in the positive sense. You're seeing that you are not a discrete entity, that you are in receipt of so much, so much. It's insight into shunyata, actually. You know, insight into emptiness, seeing that actually others have really benefited you. So gratitude. And listening to the Dhamma at proper times. And when Bhante talked about this, he said it means you listen to the Dhamma. The proper times really means you're receptive. And of course, if you have that gratitude, if you have that garbha, that reverence, if you're genuinely humble, if you're contented and grateful, then your mind will be open to reality. You know, as Aloka was saying the other day, reality is communicating all the time. But our mind is not flexible enough, is not open enough. Well, if we had these qualities, reverence, humble-heartedness, contentment and gratitude, well, reality would be pouring in. Yeah. And we wouldn't need many Dharma books. We could just pick up one line, one half line from the Dhammapada would have a huge impact on you. It would be as if the Buddha was really speaking, really talking to us if we had those qualities. So I think probably that's really enough. And just one little thing I want to add, again, just to underline the importance of reverence. A bit later on, I discovered, again, through Bhante's blessing, through his teaching, the opening words from the Ratnaguna Sanchayagata, the verses of the precious qualities of the perfection of wisdom. And again, another, I think the first seminar that he did here, one of the first seminars on the first retreat here. And there's this wonderful verse at the beginning of this: what you need in order to listen to the perfection of wisdom, to these exalted teachings, the Buddha says, call forth as much as you can of love, of reverence and of faith. Remove the obstructing defilements and clear away all your taints. Listen to the perfect wisdom of the gentle Buddhas, taught for the weal of the world, for heroic spirits intended. It's very interesting. Para prema gaurava prasada upastapitva. Para prema gaurava prasada. Prema. So it's not just reverence and faith. There's this word prema that's used in this old Buddhist Sanskrit text. Translated as love, but that's too weak. Prema, you probably come across as a sort of near enemy of metta, of maitri, pema. It's sort of exclusive affection. But here, it's used entirely positively. You can have totally exclusive affection for the Buddha. That's fine. You can have this intense love. In Hindu bhakti tradition, bhakti means devotion. Prema is used a lot to describe the attitude of the devotee to the deity. But here it is, in a very, very old Buddhist text, this tremendous love, intense, almost erotic love. Don't take that in the wrong way. I don't mean sexual. But this intense love for the Buddhas and the Bodhisattvas, as well as reverence, as well as faith. Even the word bhakti is very interesting. It's first used actually in a Buddhist text in its Pali form. Bhakti means to have a share in. What do you have a share in? You have a share in Bhagwan. Now, usually in Hinduism, Bhagwan is the word for God. But of course, the word Bhagwan is also used for the Buddha. So your bhakti, your devotion for the Buddha, is that love which has a share in the Buddha, that has a share in the qualities of enlightenment. So all your adoring love for the Buddha's loving kindness, for his mindfulness, for that unfathomable, mysterious quality, that love that you have, that very love that you have, is a part of you. It's a part of you. It's that quality of enlightenment in you. It's very, very far away, that potential. Loving the enlightenment, the full enlightenment out there. So para prema garava prasada. Call forth as much as you can of this intense love, this reverence and this faith. Then you'll clear away the defilements. Then you'll remove all your taints. Then you can really listen. Listen to the, it says the gentle Buddhas, the word is saurata in, there's no mention of it as saurata, it's the Sanskrit for surata, who some of you know. The gentle ones, the well-disciplined ones, the happy ones, the Buddhas. You listen. I think that's enough. Thank you.